The Tom Woods Show, episode 1275.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, it's my job to equip you with the strongest arguments for the libertarian position on issue after issue where you tend to get cornered by your friends. Well, deregulation caused the financial crisis is still a big one 10 years later as people reflect on those terrible times. Very, very important to smash this one with a baseball bat. And I've got just the baseball bat for you. It's my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman. Grab it over at regulationmyths.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I got a couple of interesting things for you. The second one is just fun. If you don't like fun, then turn it off before you get to the second part. But the first part is an interview I did on the Money Metals Exchange podcast. And I see there's a page that features it from 2018, but I know this podcast was released in 2015, just based on what I say in there, how long I've been doing my own podcast. I know for a fact I did not talk to these guys in 2018. But anyway, the Money Metals Exchange podcast. So we talk a bit about money. We talk about some economic history of the U.S. and some related topics. So I hope you'll enjoy that. And I think it will supplement some of the things that I've said in previous episodes over the past 2 or 3 weeks. But then after that, what the heck? I'm going to play for you about 10 minutes of a game that we played on the Contra Cruise. Of course, you know that's the cruise that Bob Murphy and I host. So far, we've been doing it every year. We'll be making an announcement about the 2019 cruise. But we were joined as a special guest by Naomi Brockwell, who's been a guest on this show. She's just tremendous, multi-talented, and just a wonderful person to have on board. She hosts this crypto quiz show in different contexts at different conferences, and she wanted to do it on board the Contra Cruise, and it turned out to be a big success. And the contestants were Bob Murphy, my co-host on Contra Krugman, Tatiana Moroz, who's a musician we've had on this show also, and me. So I'm only going to play for you the 10 minutes where each of us has been assigned a celebrity we have to guess. So obviously we don't know any of the names. I don't know who Bob or Tatiana's are, and I don't know who my own is. You have to ask, it's like 20 questions. You have to ask yes or no questions of the audience, and until you get a no answer, you can keep asking. And I think you'll get a kick out of it because it just was fun. The audio is pretty crisp, but it's just generally recording the room. So people speaking into the mic are louder, but not because we were recording through a board or anything. It was just somebody recorded it. It may have been Naomi herself, but it's perfectly fine. And I think you'll maybe get a kick out of it. I'll put the whole video at tomwoods.com/1275. Because after that, we had a funny round where we had to buzz in after a quotation was read to us, and we had to determine whether that quotation was Trump speaking about China or Krugman speaking about Bitcoin. That was kind of fun. And then in the final round, we had to, on the basis of attributes that were assigned to us, we had to design a cryptocurrency. We had to design our own cryptocurrency, but we were given what the criteria were, what the attributes of the coin would be, and then we had to make a pitch for it. So anyway, all that will be up at tomwoods.com/1275. If you just want to watch something that's kind of fun, then go ahead and do that. So first comes the interview on the Money Metals Exchange podcast. Then comes the excerpt from the Contra Cruise. Here we go.
Tom, first off, I want to thank you for spending some time with us, and I'm excited to have you on today. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, your background in both U.S. and world history, along with your understanding of free market economic theory, is the primary reason we asked you to come on today, because history is such an important guide for us. Now, first, I want to have you take us back to the formation of our country and give us a brief summary, if you would, about why our founding fathers devised and constructed things the way they did, primarily as it relates to our money and our monetary system, and the role that gold and silver were to play. So first off, before we get into how much we've gotten off track from what the founders had in mind, talk about why they came up with a bimetallic system that used gold and silver.
Well, it was very common in colonial times for people to use actually a Spanish coin that was the most frequently used coin. It was called the Spanish milled dollar, and it was a silver coin. This was in wide circulation. And it's true that there were episodes in which paper money was used in the colonies. We see that first in Massachusetts in 1690. And Benjamin Franklin was actually agitating for paper money in Pennsylvania. And it turned out that guess whose print shop was going to get the contract to print the money? So, you know, it might not have been entirely an economic argument that old Ben was making in that case. But by and large, there was, with the exception of the Revolutionary War, there was an emphasis on hard money. Now, of course, during the Revolutionary War, we all know the standard story, which is that the continental currency was continually debased. It was a paper kind of money, and it would be debased. We even have a story of somebody wanting to pay back a debt, and the money was so worthless that the creditor was actually running away. The person was threatening to repay him. He didn't want to be repaid in that type of worthless currency. So a lot of people drew conclusions from this that it's much, much better to have a sound currency, a sound money that can't be so easily manipulated by government. And that is the reason that precious metals, gold and silver in particular, have been the money in so many parts of the world. I mean, they were money for 1,000 years at least in the Byzantine Empire. That's why. And in fact, Ludwig von Mises, the great economist, said that sound money belongs right up there with bills of rights and written constitutions in terms of guarantees of the rights of the people. Sound money. It's disparaged today. It's made fun of today. People say it's backward and stupid and we're much more sophisticated now, but there's nothing to that whatsoever.
Now, the hard money advocates did face some dissension, however. Talk about what followed and some of the key moments in our monetary history during, say, the first 100 years of our nation.
I do want to say just a little something about how other people who might have had maybe looser monetary ideas came to hold hard money ideas. The Panic of 1819 in U.S. history was a pivotal moment because there you had a case in which a lot of people blamed the First Bank of the United States and the state banks for having initiated a major flood of money printing. So you had the First Bank being decommissioned just around the time of the War of 1812. But then we get the Second Bank, we get a lot of inflationary activity going on at the state bank level, and people concluded that the reason that the economy had been so unstable in the years prior to the Panic of 1819, leading up to that panic, was precisely that you had artificial encouragement of the creation of paper money. And that if we had had a sounder money system and we hadn't allowed the government to accept the paper money, so that that would have given us a particular impetus to the use of hard money, we wouldn't have had this up and down kind of economic fortune. And so you see numerous Americans coming to the conclusion that what we need is, in fact, as Jefferson said at the time, let's try and take all the paper money in circulation now and retire it and replace it entirely with a 100% hard money system. And so we see this people like Jefferson all down the line, over and over. You see people saying, you know, I might have been wrong about money in the past. Jefferson was always sound on money. But clearly this Panic of 1819 has taught us something. So that was the narrative. You see this repeatedly in U.S. history. In 1857, the Panic of 1857, President James Buchanan said that the thing that's causing this is not the gold standard. It's precisely that we have banks that are going off the gold standard, that are creating all this phony baloney money. And then we have these laws at the state level that allow them to do this. And then when people make a run on the bank to try to get their money back and the banks can't give it to them, we have laws that let the banks stay in business for a couple of years while they try and fetch these people's money. He says, that's just crazy. That's giving special privileges to the banks. So there's a lot of sound knowledge and sound analysis of money in the 19th century, from the early part up to the mid-19th century in the U.S.
A little over 100 years ago, Wall Street special interests started pushing silver out of the monetary system in favor of a gold-only standard. And then things really started going off the tracks a few years later when banking elites met secretly to devise the Federal Reserve. Talk about that event, why they felt the need to form the Fed, and some of the consequences that immediately followed in those first years and decades afterwards.
The long and the short of it is that it was thought that if we centralize the monetary system in the U.S. Now, they tried to conceal the fact that they were centralizing it by creating all these regional Federal Reserve banks, but this is mostly window dressing. What they wanted to do was to centralize the money supply not so much at the beginning because they wanted to plan the economy the way the Fed does today, where they have inflation targets and they're trying to target employment and output and trying to make sure they balance everything. That wasn't really on their minds. That wasn't really what economics was saying at that time. But instead, it was thought that the banking sector will be more stable if we have an institution governing it that can, in fact, control it in some way, that can keep an eye on that can centralize reserves and that can create money in particular circumstances when it would relieve stress on the system. So they were thinking about the panic of 1907 when we had a series of difficulties, particularly in New York with a series of banks. And it was thought if we had this one institution that could be a backstop for the whole system, and that could, when the banks need liquidity, could create that money, and that could serve as basically a kind of a lender of last resort, this would create more stability. Now, of course, not considered was maybe you could create a more stable system and without the need for a lender of last resort if the banks weren't engaged in all these shady practices, if they were keeping good control over the money that had been entrusted to them, they wouldn't be having these problems in the first place. But instead, much easier than just engaging in sound banking practices was to have a bailout system in case you engage in riskier banking practices. And so that was, you know, leave aside all the phony baloney sugarcoating explanations for the Fed. This was the intent. And just think of it. There's no other industry that has a lender of last resort. There's no other industry that has a bailouter of last resort. It's only banking. And it was the idea was we all basically want to create money beyond the gold holdings that we have. Everybody wants to do that. But there's a risk that people will catch on to what we're doing and come try and claim their money when they think we've created too much paper. So the idea of the Fed would be, especially as the 20th century wore on, that the Fed would be a coordinator of the inflation so that all the banks would be inflating at roughly the same rate so that all the various withdrawals on net would tend to cancel each other out and the system could be maintained and the banks could profit in this way instead of just having to operate like every other kind of institution in the economy whereby you are expected to be a good husbander of your resources. And you are expected to pay out on demand. There'd be nobody would think it would be acceptable to have a dry cleaner that if I went to pick up my dry cleaning and the cleaner said, well, my wife is wearing your pants, but when she gets them back next week, I'll give them back to you. Nobody would think that was acceptable. So if we had a central dry cleaning agency that could, you know, stitch together a pair of pants for a situation like that, we wouldn't really think that was the way to go. We would say, don't engage in this type of behavior to begin with. Banks should be earning their money in other ways. They should be earning their money through time deposits where people give their money for a period of time. The banks know this. They invest that money for that period of time. The money is not available to you during that period of time or only at a penalty. And then at the conclusion of that period, you can get your money back with interest. That's how banks can engage in traditional banking activity without the shenanigans that lead them to demand a central bank.
What is the harm of punishing savers the way the current system seems to do? I mean, we talk about, you know, the war on cash a lot on this program, and then you've got potentially negative interest rates coming out. What are some of the ramifications of that type of policy as we progress through time here, punishing savers?
They do this because they think that if they punish saving, they can force people to spend. They did that in Japan deliberately. They even used the word threat. We should threaten that we're going to destroy your purchasing power to get people to go out there and buy consumer goods. But this is a juvenile understanding of how an economy works. An economy is not just dollar bills chasing consumer goods, and then the consumer goods sellers use their dollar bills to buy more consumer goods, and then those recipients buy more consumer goods. That's the way a seven-year-old looks at the economy. But there's much more to it. We don't want just consumption. That's not what we want, because we want production. We want investment. That's all left out of this juvenile force people to spend. When people save, they are making resources available for investment purposes. They're making it possible for investors to build new retail outlets, to build new factories, to engage in more research and development. By foregoing spending and by abstaining from spending, people are releasing resources for use by entrepreneurs. They are doing something important in the economy. It's not the case that we necessarily want to artificially encourage them to go out and instead just buy toothbrushes today. We want long-term projects to be undertaken. That's how you get long-term growth. And moreover, if we think about the pure logic of their position, imagine if I have $10 and I just go and spend it on 3 gallons of milk, and because that's a good thing, because I think I'm helping the economy by buying consumer goods. Well, okay, it does help the milk seller. Well, suppose we go along with this idea that consumer goods spending is all that matters. Then we would want the milk seller to go out and buy, let's say, a cheap shirt at Walmart. And then the Walmart person would have to go out and buy, a pair of sandals. And then the sandal person could go out and buy a magazine subscription. But notice every single step would be consumption, 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 consumption. But if we had an economy that functioned like that, we would revert to barbarism almost immediately, because there'd be no payrolls, because that's not consumption. There'd be no business investment, that's not consumption. There'd be no capital maintenance, because that's not consumption. So everything would be crumbling around us. Nothing would be kept up. There'd be no investment for the future. There'd be no thought of, of course, we realize as soon as we try to implement a consumption-only economy, we see that consumption does not drive the economy. This consumption is 70% of the economy is nonsense. It's a phony baloney calculation that leaves out a huge chunk of what goes on, all the intermediate stages of production between the raw materials and the finished product are a big part of production, and they're left out of the figures altogether. None of that would be done. None of those intermediate stages of production, none of the maintenance of capital, none of that would be kept up if all we thought about, we were obsessed with consumption. We don't want that. So yeah, that what they're trying to do is to get us to run out and spend. They're trying to punish people who want to save. It's true. And of course, there isn't a whole lot that we can do about that. They're putting us in an extremely difficult position, and it forces people to become even more speculative with their money, because now they really can't provide for their futures. It's absolutely horrifying, and we should not allow the so-called experts to portray themselves as the saviors of the economy when they're absolutely killing the average person.
When it comes to the world of academia, you're a bit of a black sheep, so to speak, in terms of the ideals of liberty and speaking out against the dangers of too much government intervention in markets and the harm of Keynesian theory, which just dominates most of the economic and political thinking these days. So why is it that the Austrian school is in such a minority in the mainstream financial world, and especially in the field of academia? For instance, economic scholars like Richard Ebeling, who we've been fortunate enough to have on this program before, don't get much recognition compared to someone like, say, Paul Krugman. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, the way academia works typically is it's not just that it favors state solutions, although it obviously does. It's not going to bite the hand that feeds it. But secondly, it's that the way academic knowledge proceeds is not some linear thing where every year the knowledge increases slightly and you can just graph it. It's that there's a way of thinking, and I hate the word paradigm. It's a terrible word, but I have to use it in here. There's a paradigm. There's, like, for instance, when you had Isaac Newton talking about physics. Well, we thought about Isaac Newton's style kind of physics, and we that was the way everybody operated. It wasn't like we had Newtonian physics, and then 2% of it became Einsteinian physics, but it was 98% Newton still, and then it became 10% Einstein and 90% Newton, and then 30% Einstein and 70% Newton. It didn't happen that way at all. Overnight, it became Einsteinian, period. So it doesn't move smoothly, the history of thought. One paradigm gives way to another. So the Austrian school, in fact, was, it seems strange to say it today, but it really was the reigning paradigm, or one of them, for quite a while. I mean, it was the Austrian school that had the major theoretical insights about marginal utility starting in the 1870s. And a lot of what the Austrian school had to say was highly mainstream and acceptable. But after the Great Depression, the shysters exploited that and said, well, the Great Depression proves that the free market left to its own devices gives you all these problems, so we can't have that anymore. But it wasn't a free market. It was a totally manipulated market. Every country in the world had a 1920s period in which its central bank was manipulating the money supply and pushing interest rates artificially low. Those are the ingredients of the business cycle. That's the whole Austrian point. So that's the thing is that we've now seen a replacement of one paradigm by another. Now, on the other hand, the Keynesians have suffered. They did suffer in the 1970s because they could not account for the stagflation, but they've had a roaring comeback ever since the financial crisis. What I would say, though, is that the Austrian school is nevertheless growing in academia, slowly, but it is growing. It's much bigger than it's ever been. We have hundreds of professors who teach in the Austrian tradition throughout the United States, and it is not the kiss of academic death. You get plenty of economics departments who think it would be very nice to have an Austrian or two on the department just to give another perspective on things. And certainly the most robust school where we see the greatest growth is the Austrian school. So things are definitely changing. They're much better than they were even 10 years ago. I didn't think we'd get to a point where we would have this much enthusiasm among young people. I don't know of any young people who are Keynesians who spend a week of their summers at a Keynesian economics institute having the time of their lives, but they do that at the Mises Institute every summer.
As we begin to wrap up here, Tom, what do you see happening with precious metals in terms of their importance in the monetary system moving forward? And how about the importance it could play from maybe a personal investor standpoint, given all these economic headwinds, massive inflationary measures, and so on?
Well, I would say that you're certainly not going to go wrong holding precious metals, but make sure you understand what you're doing and go in with your eyes open, because they will have ups and downs. There's just no getting around that. So you're not buying it to get rich, and you're not buying it for 6 months from now. You're buying it partly as a hedge against any kind of real disaster, and partly as something to hold for the long term. So, don't be thrown if it should go down. Because you shouldn't be thinking in terms of the short run. You should be thinking way, way in the future when you do that. Now, in terms of precious metals playing a role in the economy or in the monetary system in the U.S., well, that is, that's something I can't predict, because it could happen. Crazier things have happened. But I think before that can happen, we need to continue to have more successes in terms of promoting the ideas of Austrian economics, using all these resources we have available to us now on the internet, where we can get our ideas out there for free. We have to persuade people that there's merit to what we're saying. And certainly Ron Paul played an important role in breaking through the blackout on this subject. And you could see that, well, here's a guy who's obviously informed, who says there's something wrong with the current system and we need to think about alternatives. Well, the more we talk about that, the greater the likelihood is. But the more we let ourselves be intimidated by the other side, because we say, I don't have the knowledge necessary to defend myself, so I better just keep quiet, buy some gold, and shut up. Well, that's better than nothing, but I think we should have higher aspirations than that.
Well, it's truly great stuff and all very fascinating, if not a little bit scary to think about. But as you mentioned, more and more people do need to contemplate these subjects and they need to know about it. And speaking of that, Tom, before we let you go, please tell our listeners about what you're working on these days, a little bit about the Tom Woods Show, the Liberty Classroom, the website, and anything else they need to know about.
I have, for the past 2 years, been producing a free daily podcast, Monday through Friday, about half an hour a day, on every topic under the sun relating to the general issues of liberty. Sure, sound money is a major part of that, but everything you can think about that would have anything to do with liberty, whether it's war and foreign policy or the Constitution, or, hey, if you hate government so much, why don't you move to Somalia? You get that a lot. So I answered that on the show, or the FDA, or whatever. All these agencies, we couldn't possibly live without them, or what would we do without the welfare state, and all these sorts of questions that you get confronted with and you're expected to have a quick pat answer. I give you the pat answers because I have the best guests in the world coming on that show. So that's TomWoods.com. It's free Monday through Friday. The tagline is, become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Now, not everybody listening to this will be a libertarian necessarily, but you're going to find the topics quite congenial. So I do that. TomWoods.com is the pivot around which everything I do revolves. So you mentioned Liberty Classroom site. You know, we know that in the university system today, you are not going to learn the history and economics that you should learn. And a lot of us get out of college and we feel gypped. I didn't learn what I know I should know. I learned a boatload of propaganda, but I didn't get the real thing. So I created a website where you do get the real thing, where professors like me, I have a PhD in U.S. history, teach economics, the real economics, Ludwig von Mises economics, F.A. Hayek economics, real U.S. history, not the politically correct version, courses where you can learn the stuff we should have gotten in school so that you don't have to bite your tongue the next time you're around colleagues who disagree with you. You'll know exactly what the arguments are. You can learn in your car with these courses. It's over at libertyclassroom.com. I think it's the most important project I've ever done. So that and TomWoods.com would be the most important two things, I would say, that I've been up to in recent years.
Well, whenever the name Tom Woods comes up in conversation around the halls of our Money Metals Exchange offices, we often comment about how great it is to have you on our side. And by that, I mean the side of liberty, capitalism, Austrian economics, and so forth. You're a tremendous ambassador for the cause and a great historian, and we're delighted you agreed to talk with us today. So we wish you the best of success in your personal pursuits and business pursuits. Thanks for the time. Really appreciate it, and hope you have a great weekend.
You too, Mike. Thank you very much.
All right, everybody, here comes the fun part. You ready? Here I am with Bob and Tatiana on a panel hosted by Naomi Brockwell aboard the Contra Cruise this past October 2018. So I hope you enjoy this. We're each trying to guess some important person, and we'll see who has success here. Here we go.
So these are our characters. I'm pretty sure you're going to know who they all are. And if you're ready, you can go ahead and you can start there, Bob.
So I'm asking you, like...
You can ask me, you can ask the audience, and we'll give you an answer. Yes or no questions?
Wait, before we start, can we assume that we both have male people and she has a female, or is that not an assumption?
I don't think you should ever assume someone's gendered. Deducted
then.
Oh my gosh.
You're gonna make me guess a woman? I like your cooties. Right.
Gender neutral questions
only.
Okay.
Is my person alive?
Yes.
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 Okay, no. No, you get another question.
You can say no.
Is it
20 questions?
No, they get as many questions as it takes, but if he gets a question wrong, then he passes it on.
If he answers no to his question?
If he answers no, then you pass it on.
Because he didn't get it right or wrong. He's
just like, what's my line?
Okay. Is it a male?
Yes.
Is it a person in crypto?
No. Tatiana.
Okay.
Is it a male?
Yes.
No.
I am just condemned to be the straight man forever. Okay. Is my person, whether we like the ideas or not, is my person in the world of ideas?
Yes.
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 You can answer me.
Okay. Is my person somebody we would broadly consider to be on the side of the good guys?
Yes.
It depends. Yeah. It definitely depends. Yeah, I'll give you a yes.
Let me
continue. I'll give you a yes.
Okay.
I'll give you a yes.
Okay. Is my person alive?
Yes.
Okay. is my person... I'm 46. Is my person older than I am?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go with the audience then.
Okay. Yeah. Is there a possibility that I have met the person?
Yes.
Has the person ever been in politics?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yes.
Is the person from Texas?
No.
No.
You were thinking maybe they weren't sure if Ron Paul's in politics. Is my person involved in business?
Yes.
Oh my God. I'm going to go with no.
I would say yes.
Right? You say yes?
It's bad enough we're guessing. You guys can see the answer. It's good that you're not here.
I'm going to go with no. Because it's, yeah. Go with, listen, I'm going with Jeff. Jeff, what do you say? All right, that's a no. Tatiana.
So Jeff is no.
Well, just because he's real smart.
Is my person a girl?
I'm sorry for Tatiana. She's had nothing but reasonable today. I think we get another shot at this kind of clown after this one's over. Okay, has my person at any time been involved in any form of entertainment?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it Glenn Jacobs?
No.
But that was a good guess.
Good answer.
Is my person an athlete?
No.
Am I dealing with a person at all?
Yes.
Ridiculous cheating there.
Yeah, Bob wants to know if it's Hillary Clinton. Is the person currently in politics?
No.
Oh, that rules out a lot of people.
Strong no. Must be no.
Is the person, is my person a person of ideas?
Yes.
Yes.
Has the person written a book?
Yes.
Yes.
Is the person an economist?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it somebody we would like?
No.
Is it someone we might have liked him on stage?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a lot of detail.
That's a lot of way there.
Too much.
That's my prerogative. I
can I guess who my person is? Or my thing is? Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yeah.
Guessing
this round.
I wonder how you came to that.
I don't know how you came from behind like that. And you won. That's
so awesome.
Can you spend 30 seconds just explain that to us?
How did you come up with that?
Well, you don't know if it's a boy, and you don't know if it's a girl, you don't know if it's a person or not. So.
Well, then, given that all I can do is guess a name, and I highly doubt that it's the person, but he matches every single criterion. David Stockman.
No.
All right, so mine, male, alive, not in Bitcoin, business kind of, wrote a book that we might have liked in the past, but now we don't like, it's Tom Woods.
That's it. We just lose? Bob and I just lose?
No, you keep guessing. Keep guessing until you get it. The next one to get it gets 5 points.
So then I'll be at a clean zero. That'll be good.
Does he get questions or just guesses?
You keep asking questions. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to recap with you guys.
All right.
So this is somebody who's alive, who's older than I am, somebody I'm likely to have met, who has been in politics, who is more or less associated with the world of ideas, who would be considered a good guy by us, who's not from Texas. Who's sort of been in entertainment.
Yep.
Is it Vince Vaughn?
No.
Okay, because I never met him. I was sitting near him, but I never met him.
Oh, I think I know.
Alan Greenspan?
Yeah.
Who's the loser up here?
All right, do you want to take one guess?
I asked such good questions.
still get the second place tie.
Okay.
You can guess it in this.
Okay, but do I have to just guess the person, or can I ask more questions? I have to guess the person.
You can ask yes. You can ask yes questions.
Okay.
Hang
on.
If he gets a no,
If he gets a no, then it's done, and you got second place. But if he gets yes questions and then asks,
then we try.
Right. I make the rules, and I sometimes make them up as I go. So.
Look, I never met Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You met this guy.
That's not a question.
That's not a question.
I'm thinking out loud, if that's okay. Getting a little testy here. All right. Okay, this is a man?
We should clarify the politics question.
Do you want to clarify? Are we allowed to... Don't give too much away, but...
Okay.
You clarified the ideas question for Bob.
That's true.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You want to give a? Don't give two.
Well, okay. Is there something more that I need to know about the politics aspect
yeah.
of this person?
Yes. This person ran for office.
Oh no! No, that's
plenty.
Okay.
But too much.
That's enough.
That is enough. That's
TMI.
I cannot figure this out.
You're
going to
create
yourself.
All
right.
You got this.
What are you doing?
Okay, is the person in entertainment now?
Yes.
Is the person in music?
No.
Oh, thank you, everybody.
All right,
who was it? Should we give him, like, some clues, or should we just tell him?
Connecticut.
Peter Schiff entertaining. Highly dubious, people. Highly dubious.
All right, so Tatiana is the winner of that round. 10 points. And Tom, you got a 2 for a...
But remember, I was -5 at the start for my
gender. That's true, so you're at -3. Thank you for reminding me.
I want to do more of this celebrity hits. All right, folks, now wasn't that fun? Wasn't that fun? All right, before I let you go, here's a great site, especially for those of you who have kids trying to learn math. It's learnskipcounting.com. And the way they describe it is this: learning multiplication can seem daunting to both children and adults. It can be so much fun, and Learn Skip Counting is here to help. I homeschool 3 children, and I couldn't find many fast and fun ways for multiplication memorization. I stumbled upon a few nursery rhyme renditions and came up with additional short songs that have entertained our family and other homeschool friends. To help others, I put all the short songs onto learnskipcounting.com and YouTube. I hope everyone has as much fun as we've had with these recognizable tunes. So there's a really, really helpful resource if you're teaching multiplication. Whether or not your kids are struggling, this will make it easier for them. So the site is learnskipcounting.com, and I'll link to that as well at tomwoods.com/1275. They got this nice publicity for their site because they used my link to get their web hosting. And if you do the same, then I'll publicize your site to my audience, give you a nice juicy backlink on my website, 2 dozen video tutorials to get you up and running quickly, and membership, if you like, in my private mutual help bloggers group. How do you get all these benefits? Check them out at tomwoods.com/publicity. Tomorrow, I got a bonus episode for you with a descendant of Patrick Henry. And we're going to be talking about what a great entrepreneur this guy is. He started in earnest, really, at age 14, if you can believe that. Actually, maybe even before that, maybe even middle school. It's just crazy, this guy. Absolutely crazy. But he knows everything as a result, and that's why we're talking to him. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.